So, good morning, Natalie. This is Michael Ward. It's the 16th of November of 2020. And Natalie Mincher, you are a consultant, I believe. We've not met before, but thank you for taking part. You're a consultant at Newport.
In Gwent, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about where you did your training and when you got your consultant post and when you decided.
Okay, so all of my training was in Wales. So I started as a medical student back in 2000 and then took a bit of a scenic route through training. But it's all been based in Wales. And then I actually got my consultant post in November of 2019. So I'd only been in post for about 3 months or so before the pandemic struck, so it was a slightly strange start to my consultant career in that sense that I didn't really get much chance to settle in to be a consultant before everything was different to what everybody expected.
So you're a full-time consultant?
I am, yeah.
And what's do you have a specialty interest?
So I normally do peri-op, so pre-op clinics, and I will be working on the post-operative care unit, and also head and neck is my other interest as well.
And so what happened? You were appointed, you said, in 2019. When in 2019?
November, so right at the end.
And you'd been in post then, what, 3 months, 4 months?
About 3 months.
Things started going funny.
Yeah, so I think we were quite quick off the mark in Newport to start planning for things, and I think a lot of the other specialties in the hospital thought that perhaps we were going a bit bonkers a bit too soon in March when we had our kind of departmental like audit meeting. We sort of realized that this was about to hit, I think, and we hadn't yet had any cases at the very beginning of March in our hospital, but there was a sort of massive feeling that we needed to prepare for this because it was coming. And it was quite incredible, actually, the way that the anaesthetic department and the ITU are traditionally quite close knit in Newport, and everybody really pulled together in a way that I've really not seen before. So within that first sort of day, we'd organized, we kind of split into groups, and we were setting up training, setting up how we were going to manage where to put the you know, the patients, all reorganizing theatres and ITU, and who was going to sort out setting up the theatres so that they could be used as extra ITU space, and making sure that the laminar flow was in place so that we could intubate negative pressure, negative pressure areas, so that we could intubate safely, and setting up intubation rooms. There were other people that were in charge of liaising with emergency medicine. One of the things I did was I wrote the intubation protocol for tubing COVID patients, because we didn't really know at the time how to do it safely for the staff as well as the patients. We didn't really know if they were going to desaturate like a stone, which they did, and how to kind of best protect ourselves and other patients in the hospital as well. So it was really quite amazing. So, and we also stopped elective surgery in the hospital, either when we only had very few patients or maybe even none at all, in order to get everybody trained up ready for the first wave. And thankfully we did, because we were hit quite hard.
How easy was it for you to persuade not only the hospital management but also the surgeons to stop elective surgery?
It wasn't. Thankfully, I, as one of the newer consultants, didn't have to take that on firsthand. That was obviously down to the CDs in the department, but I don't think it was easy. And I think it took a little bit of time. Then there was a bit of a lag time before everybody kind of got on board with it. But we had already sort of started setting up. The main thing was training and making sure that we all knew how to use the PPE properly, and the kind of processes for where patients were to go through the hospital. So yeah, there was a lot to organise in a short time. And I think once other departments started to see what we were doing, they started to kind of realise that it was the right way to go. And I think certainly in Newport anyway, the anaesthetic department was definitely leading the way in the preparation, anaesthetics and ITU combined, leading the way in getting ready.
Do you remember when did you see your first patients with?
It was mid-March. It was mid-March or towards the end of March. And I think people still didn't quite believe that it was going to happen. And then we ended up with a patient who had been in one of the sister hospitals and was transferred in with respiratory problems. They had been in for a few days before it was kind of realized that he actually was the first COVID patient, by which point he had been treated by a number of our department who then contracted COVID from him, from the first patient. So straight away we had quite a lot of the department went down with it. So we had a lot of sickness early on, around the same time as, you know, the first wave was starting to ramp up. So we were kind of hit from both sides, really, because we had a lot of patients coming in and we also had a lot of staff not in.
Can I ask, do you think that, if you like, epidemic within the department, if I can call it that, was because people had not been cognizant of the need for PPE, or was it failures of PPE and improper usage of PPE? Which of those factors?
I think it was that it wasn't used in the first instance, because I don't think people thought this was going to be, you know, COVID already. I think it was still, at that time, it was still a disease of it that they had in Italy that we hadn't really seen yet. And I don't think people were on board. Plus, the patient didn't have any particular risk factors. So he hadn't been to Italy. He hadn't been to China. I think he'd worked with somebody who'd been to Italy recently or something like that. But there was him. He himself hadn't been, you know, to one of the at-risk areas or anything. So it wasn't really on people's radar that this might be the first case.
Wow. Was testing available at that stage?
Yes. Yes.
Right. So once they were tested and they were found positive, you were able to separate them or treat them, and people learned to behave differently.
Yeah, definitely. Straight away, once we realised that it was a go,
right.
Everything kicked in, and then obviously the staff that had been affected were off. But one of the first people to go down was one of the intensive care consultants, one of the very experienced intensive care consultants, and that was a bit of a blow. So he was already off. But in a way, it was almost a good thing, because a lot of people were then back to work by the time it really hit the peak. So we kind of got that out of the way towards the beginning, I think.
You can smile about it now, but it must have been very frightening and very worrying, I should think.
It was frightening, because we didn't have a clue what how this disease was going to progress and how it was going to spread. But I think certainly at the beginning of the first wave, the overwhelming feeling was almost kind of like a sort of blitz mentality, I imagine, where, you know, everybody was really kind of ready for it and morale was really high. People were really kind of working as a team, and there was a lot of good feeling. I certainly didn't feel a sense of dread or that I was frightened. I felt quite safe in my PPE once I was trained how to use it. And I think I was really reassured by the fact that my colleagues were all on board and everybody was trying to help each other. And I think, you know, it really, really was a case that, like, people that didn't normally do a particular job would happily go into that area and help. So, I mean, I don't do ITU, but I have recently done ITU as a registrar because I'm a new consultant. So, you know, I went back into ITU for a few shifts and was an ITU reg, which was fine. And everybody was very happy to do, you know, those kinds of things. And the nursing staff particularly were incredible, being, you know, moved out of their normal role and into ITU and things like that. It was amazing. So it was scary, but I think the overwhelming feeling, certainly the first time round, was that the public were with us and the, you know, all the staff were in it together, and we were really kind of, yeah, we were ready to take it on.
Now, I know that you're there with a partner. I don't know whether it's your husband or a flatmate or what, but is he medical?
No, he's not.
And how did he feel about you going off to work in a place where people were getting really sick, the staff were getting sick as well?
So, I guess you'd have to ask him. I think I was concerned at the beginning that I was going to, we've got children as well, so I was concerned that I was going to bring something home to him and the children. I think he was worried about me, but he knew it was my job, and his dad was a fireman, so I think he was, you know, used to people going to work and knowing that they were potentially doing a slightly dangerous job. Right. And every day, you know, I'd come home and I would leave all my things in the porch and go straight to the shower and change before I went anywhere near any of them and that kind of thing. So we settled into a routine quite quickly.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I mean, I've heard people describe the way they would return home. In fact, one of the people I've interviewed didn't return home. I think he stayed away for 8 weeks or nearly 8 weeks.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly.
So people did.
People developed avoidance techniques because they were so anxious. It must have been very worrying for all of you, I'm sure. But let's move on. So you now have a situation where you're not doing any elective. You're managing patients. How bad did it get? How many patients did you have at the peak?
I believe that we had about 40 intubated and we've got 12 ITU beds is our normal max.
And you've watched the various therapeutic regimes develop. What were the things that made a difference to you and to your patients, obviously, more?
So initially I was largely involved with kind of scooping the patients up, intubating them, moving them into ITU, putting lines in and getting them settled. And to start with, in terms of the drugs we were using, we started off, well, we think we are still using ketamine for everybody, but we were really worried that everybody was going to be massively hypotensive and nosedive on induction. And actually that didn't happen. We realized that they were actually, if anything, they were getting hypertensive and that we probably needed to add a bit of opiate or something in as well, because they were all going the other way. Quickly realized that they were massively desaturating quickly when we were intubating, and it was just really quickly obvious that what we thought we needed, we thought we'd had all the kit, we thought we had everything planned to a T, and then you'd realise that you didn't have one particular bit of kit in the room and no one could go and get it because everybody was in PPE and everybody was, you know, everything was sealed off. So yeah, things quickly changed where we realised we needed to change the equipment list and make sure that we had a spare of everything in the room, like a whole extra set of drugs because somebody dropped a vial of rocuronium on one of the first ones. And, you know, it was just that kind of thing, which all sounds obvious, but you'd sort of realize, oh, can you go? Oh, no, we can go and get that. So it was that kind of thing. And then in terms of when we first started seeing patients coming in, we were intubating everybody early because that's what we thought was the best thing to do. And that's what the data from Italy had suggested that we should be doing. And we were extubating them too early and a lot of them were going backwards and needing re-intubating. So after a while, we started to realise that we didn't need to intubate everybody straight off. A lot of them were doing better on CPAP for longer. And so certainly in the second wave, we've not seen such a wave of early intubations and people have been holding off a bit longer. We were also really concerned about using high flow nasal oxygen in the first wave as well because of the aerosolization of using high flow, but this time round we've been using it a lot more in areas that are, you know, red, where all the patients have COVID, so it doesn't really matter as long as the staff are all protected. So we've been using a lot more of that, so we had fewer patients so far at least that have been intubated particularly early. And knowing that they take a while to wean rather than trying to push them, I think has been the other thing that I've particularly noted from my ITU colleagues, that we were trying to wean them too quickly and they were just not doing and ended up coming backwards. So I think that was part of the issue of why we got so overwhelmed with numbers, because, you know, if you intubate somebody with a pneumonia and the young fit ones, usually you can get them back off the ventilator in a couple of days, but these patients, you just can't. They're there for 2 or 3 weeks as a minimum, and you just run out of beds because there's no throughput. So I think that was largely why we got so swamped with numbers, rather than that we were having hordes coming in every day. It was that we couldn't get them back out again, so we were running out of space. So I think we were having probably, at the worst point, I think we had 6 maybe in the same day was the worst day, that sort of number of new intubations.
They were all coming from the Newport and the surrounding area. You weren't bringing patients in from outside.
No, they were all coming from Newport.
Was there a plan to have a Nightingale Hospital in Wales?
Yeah, there was. And I don't know to what stage it ever got built. The plan was to turn the Millennium Stadium into, it was going to be called the Dragon's Heart Hospital. But yes, it was essentially a Nightingale.
I believe it was done. I don't know how far it went, but it certainly...
Yeah, I don't know how far it went. It did start, but I don't know if it ever got to the point of...
I noticed recently, and maybe you did as well, that the last Welsh match home match was not played at the Millennium Stadium. It was played in Llanelli, if I've said that correctly. And that, I think that was the reason, because it had become the Dragon's Heart Hospital.
There we are. It's not up and running again as a stadium.
But do you know whether they ever took patients at all?
I'm certain that they didn't. I don't think they ever did, no.
Okay. Well, one of the people I've already interviewed was the medical director, who happened to be an anaesthetist of the Greenwich Nightingale, the very big one. They had beds for, I think, something like 300 patients at one point, but they only ever had 20 odd, I believe.
Right, okay.
I might have the numbers wrong. The next thing I want to ask you is about medical treatment, because now, since over time, we've realised there are some drug interventions that can reduce both the severity and the duration of this illness. Antibiotics, dexamethasone, and there have been other... Were those being tried out in your part of the world?
Now, I can't really comment on that. Certainly, in the first wave, I know they started to use dexamethasone, but I don't know about the antivirals and things. So I wouldn't like to give you the wrong information about that.
That's fine. So you were looking after the ventilation aspects more than getting directly involved with their, if you like, the more general medical side of their treatment.
Yeah, so the way we organised things was that all of the trainees went and became ITU trainees. So none of them stayed in anaesthetics. And then the consultants split into teams of four, and so we would be on call, so like I did every Tuesday night and every Thursday day, and you know, there was a kind of rotation, so I was always on with the same three other people, and then between us we had to cover obstetrics, any CPOD cases, and then any COVID admissions that came in, and we'd usually go and take turns as well to let the trainees out of ITU for a few hours to have a break. So I was doing a kind of registrar role in ITU as I would kind of go in and let people out. So we were sort of trying to also manage the, you know, the appendixes and the laparotomies and things that also needed, that didn't go away. Largely they did go away, actually. There was obviously a few things to do on the CPOD list, but it was quite bizarre at how, you know, I don't know what was happening with everybody's appendix, but they were just sitting quietly. I don't know why. The CPOD list was decimated.
I don't know the answer, and I don't think you're the first person who's mentioned this observation. And I know a lot of people with significant both surgical and medical conditions were not going to hospital because of fear of contracting COVID, I think, as well as fear of getting in the way. And the message was very much from the GPs not to go to hospital, but to try and stay at home. And this is one of the things we've learned.
And I certainly did see at least a couple of patients who had delayed coming in, and it didn't end well because they were so far through their disease progression, not COVID related.
Oh, but really?
For example, there was a young chap with Fournier's gangrene who had stayed at home for a long time, and by the time he arrived in A&E, he was moribund, and he didn't make it. No. And whether he would have done if he'd come in earlier, I don't know, but he'd certainly left it very late before he presented. And that was sort of one of the things that I remember quite clearly, as thinking, you know, this is one of the kind of collateral damage effects of this pandemic, is these people are not going to go down in the numbers as having died of COVID, but it certainly had an impact on that patient.
You mentioned that your group of four were covering things in addition to the ventilation unit, things like obstetrics. How easy was it to de-doff or undoff, I'm not sure what the right word is, get over to obstetrics? And was there not an anxiety about cross-contamination there?
So largely, we, in our group of four, there were two of us that normally do obstetrics. So that's not my thing, but there were two who were very keen to do that. So they would kind of normally be attached to obstetrics, so obviously one of us could go over and help if they needed extra help, but generally speaking there will be somebody designated to that area, somebody designated to CPOD, and then the other two would kind of be ITU / intubations / A&E type thing. So we tried not to mix across too much, but the processes were excellent I have to say, it was in every area. There was a set space to don and written instructions on the wall with pictures, so that, you know, it was idiot proof. You could just follow each step. And the same with doffing. Then it was a one way in, a one way out system for every area, and everything went into a bucket of Acticlaw. Your shoes went in, everything went in straight into the shower if you'd done an intubation or anything. So as soon as we came out of IT, we go straight into the shower, change into new scrubs, and be, you know, completely fresh and clean as we could be by the time we pop back out the other side again. So it was a sort of really well organized system.
Right. You sound as if you felt confident.
Definitely. Yeah. I felt safer in work in PPE than I did in the supermarket.
Wow.
Because I felt that it was, you know, it was protecting me. But two of our team of four did get COVID. Whether they picked it up at work or not, I guess we'll never know. But yeah, two of the four did end up getting it.
Well, that's interesting. And they're okay?
They're both fine, yeah.
Okay. How big is the department?
About 50 consultants.
Wow, it's a large department. And how many of them were directly involved with COBE? Were they all split up into these groups? Or were any
mainly. So if there were consultants who were at risk themselves, so some of them would go and work. We had some green sites. So there's a small hospital up the hill that does elective orthopedics normally. So that became trauma. And so there will be some people would go and work up there. There were other people who went to do elective cancer work in the private hospital that was NHS outsourced. Elective cancer work. So the older consultants who were no longer on the on-call rotas, and anybody who was at risk themselves, moved onto those sites and kept away from the slightly higher risk of infection areas. And yeah, all of us that were normally on the on-call rotas were down on the main site.
And how many of your colleagues at any point were positive for COVID and had to take time off?
I'd probably say about a third.
Really, as many as that? And were there any fatal cases?
No, thankfully, no.
How long did this form of work carry on for?
When did we stop doing that? So we stopped having the teams of four once everything settled down, which was probably about in July. Was that when it sort of started to settle, July, August time?
Yeah.
So we're currently not in that working pattern. So this time it's all quite different in that we're still maintaining, not elective surgery as such, but we're still doing urgent cancer work, very urgent vascular cases. So the stuff that really can't wait. I've done a couple of lap colies this week for people who have active gallstone pancreatitis, that kind of thing. So the things that can't wait, we're doing now, which we weren't doing before. And it's a whole different kind of feeling within the department this time. I think first time round, everybody had a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm. We had like a lot of gifts from the public, so a lot of food. So the staff rooms were stocked with biscuits and sweets and crisps and all the things that you could possibly want. And we had, you know, toothpaste and deodorant and shampoo and everything there ready for us if we needed it. And this time there's a definite change in that feeling. I think everybody, including the public, have kind of settled into this now, so we haven't got that kind of the staff room is decidedly bare this time around, and people are just out of energy. I think the enthusiasm to kind of fight the battle has waned a bit, and everybody's kind of got their heads down now and trudging on rather than going at it with all guns blazing this time. I think
you will be, of course, in the front line when it comes to the vaccination, when that is finally available, you and the over 85s. But then your family won't be, and your children won't be. So that must be a worry still for you, is it, or not?
I guess I'm probably the most likely vector of infection for them. Yeah. If I get vaccinated as soon as possible, that'd be the best thing to do. We all had our details taken about a month ago, so that we were on a list ready to go as soon as there was a vaccine.
I'm pleased to hear
so
that.
As soon as there is one, I'll be having it.
I mean, there is hope now, much more than there was a couple of weeks ago. but I think there are still some questions to be answered. So the public response, yeah, I think you're right that the people are fed up. I was looking at some pictures today in the newspaper of, I think it was actually from Cardiff, from one of the arcades in Cardiff, and people, there seem to be a lot of people without masks walking around. What is this reluctance? Is it the same in Wales as I see in Oxford, that you walk through the streets, there's no obligation at the moment, there's no legal requirement to wear a mask, but I have one on, but a lot of people don't. Is that the same where you are?
Well, I've certainly not been into town or anything for months. I just don't think it's worth the risk when I can do things from, I live sort of slightly further out than the town centre.
Yeah.
There is a lot of young people in groups, certainly teenagers, that kind of age, in large groups. And I did see some teenagers in the park the other day passing the same cigarette around the same group from one person's mouth to the other, which is disappointing. I understand that they're probably extremely frustrated, and it's not something that's directly affecting their age group a lot, so they're not seeing the other side of it. So I can understand why that behaviour is starting to break through. Yeah. It's just unfortunate that that is not going to help stop things in the long term. But yeah, I definitely have seen it around about.
Yeah, well, it is. Well, we'll see what happens over the next few months. It's a very interesting time. So things aren't back to normal yet.
They are not back to normal. So we're also, this week, the two hospitals within our trust have merged and a new site's opening. So that's happening now, and it's happening 4 months early, with the idea that if there is a second peak, that we'll have a bigger ITU capacity. I think previously we had 12 beds and the north site had, I think, 8, whereas the new hospital has closer to 30. So the idea is that we'll be all on one bigger site. We'll have a better chance of having a green sites where we can do some elective work and try and keep the sicker patients on the new site. So there's a lot going on for us at the moment, because it's all been brought forward, and it's a big job to open a whole new hospital.
How very brave to have gone ahead, but I can see the logic of doing it. Any other thoughts about the way your hospital has responded or is responding that you either question or that you want to make an observation on for me, that you think it's a very good example and you'd like everybody else to know about it?
I just think that it was really quite staggering how everybody got up and sorted everything out so quickly and without argument and without over discussing things. It's amazing how quickly you can get things done when there's an emergency. And I think that was one of the things that shocked me the most, was that normally there's so much red tape to go through to get a new policy in place or to get a change to happen in reality. And this was just, things were just happening straight away because they needed to happen. And it was really quite a privilege to be part of it. And the relationships between different departments was exemplary. You know, you'd have orthopaedic surgeons turning up in the department saying, well, we're not operating, what can we do? And some of them went into ITU. There were people that were involved in proning teams just to help prone the patients, because that was, you know, a lot of work for the nursing staff to do. And it was honestly one of the biggest and most impressive things I've ever seen, was the way everybody pulled together. And I don't know that it's been the same in other hospitals in the region. I don't know if that's because we were hit first, and we were hit certainly the first time round probably worst. But yeah, and I don't know how we would have got through it without that kind of that mentality. But it was really quite something to see. And there was, nobody was complaining. Nobody, you know, wanted to know if they were going to get extra money for doing extra hours or anything like that. Everybody just got on with it. And it was, you know, it was really quite something. And I think that's what got us through it, really.
Well, more power to your elbow. I mean, were there opportunities to talk to people in Cardiff or into the other hospitals in the region and compare notes? Did anybody make the effort to try and do that?
They did. I think because we were out, kind of almost out on our own. We were only probably 12 miles away from Cardiff, but initially we seemed for some reason to be hit so much worse, and at the same time they had relatively few patients, so it was difficult to compare when things were quite different. And it's such a bigger hospital in Cardiff as well. They've got a sort of 30 bedded ITU, and I think they work things quite differently there for their own reasons. But yeah, I mean, I certainly spoke to my other colleagues that are working in different hospitals, and I know that sort of further in now into the valley, sort of Merthyr, Llantrysant Way, they are really struggling now this time around. They've had a massive surge, and they've got small units with not many consultants, and that's, yeah, I think they're really under a lot of strain at the moment from both the medical and nursing side.
That's interesting. And of course, you've just come out of lockdown, haven't you?
We have just come out of lockdown. Not a huge amount has changed since we've come out of lockdown. The restrictions are still quite tight, so we still can't see anybody indoors. Right. And we still can't meet more than in groups of four outside. So it's still relatively tight.
Can I ask how you mentioned you had children. I don't know what ages they are, but how have they coped?
So I've got a 10-year-old. I did have three and I lost one. So I've got a 10-year-old and I've got a 5-year-old. The 5-year-old has been relatively happy. She's got cousins that are a similar age, and certainly at certain points she's been allowed to go and play with her cousins. So that has kept her happy. The 10-year-old has struggled a lot. She's missed her friends. I mean, they were off school from March to September with very little sort of contact, certainly with anybody her own age. And yeah, she's really struggled, and she's so much happier now she's back at school.
During your lockdown, schools were closed as well, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is the difference between England, of course.
So they closed on, it was the weekend, she was actually on a school trip, and they had to close, they stopped the school trip early and came home, and it was the same week as her birthday, so we had to cancel a birthday party. So she kind of missed out. So that was towards the end of March. And then, yeah, they closed then and didn't reopen again until the sort of second week of September. So they were off for nearly 6 months.
Yeah. And were they providing any education online for them, or were they just up to their own device? They were.
They had online work to do, which was difficult. My husband and I both work full time, so he was working from home, but he was also working full time from home. And thankfully, we've got a 10-year-old and a 5-year-old who don't need the same level of supervision as a baby would. I mean, a 10-year-old and a 5-year-old can sit and watch a TV program whilst you sit and work at the dinner table. So, you know, it wasn't as difficult for us as it would have been for other people, but it was really difficult to try and keep them educated to a degree, as well as go to work. So yeah, it's been a struggle. There's been hub schools. We didn't qualify for the hub school because my husband's not a key worker. He's a lawyer. And in our particular area, you had to have two key worker parents to qualify for the hub school. So he was landed with the task of looking after them in the day. And a lot of it went by the wayside, I have to be honest, but they had online work, and we'd try and take them out for a walk every day. We weren't allowed to go too far. To start with, we were only allowed to go 5 miles was the initial rule. So we were just sort of walking from the house around the woods, spotting the rainbows in the windows and things to keep them occupied. So it was a long 6 months.
I'm sure it was. Well, this has been absolutely fantastic for me to hear your story. I mean, is there anything else that you can think of to add to what you've said already? I mean, it's not over yet, but no. I get the impression from what you're saying that life is easier and there is some degree of hope. Would that be a fair summary or unfair?
Yes, I think the overwhelming feeling is everyone's a bit tired and fed up, as the general public are, and we just want this to be over now. But the kind of fear element has gone largely, I think.
What do you put that down to? Do you think that's the fact that we have hope of a vaccine, or because people are surviving better?
A little from column A and a little from column B, and also I think we're just used to it now. I think we're just so used to, you know, working in, I mean, in PPE, even, you know, doing the CPOD list, we're wearing all red PPE still. And we're just used to it now. I'm used to wearing an FFP3 mask for many hours a day and a visor and, you know, a gown and gloves for every case. I don't even think twice about it now. Whereas before it seemed quite cumbersome and it was like walking around in a space suit, but I'm doing it every day and I'm just used to it. And I think we're just kind of getting more into the routine of things and the pattern of things. Yeah. And it's not a fear of the unknown anymore. It's a known now. So we're just kind of getting on with it.
Do you think we will actually get back to what was our previous norm? Or do you think...
No, I don't think we will. I think we are probably going to be thinking more about infection control in the future. I think traditionally, like if I was intubating somebody, I wouldn't wear a mask or, you know, worry about that I was going to catch anything from the patient when I was putting the tube in. But I think that's probably changed. And I think we will all be having maybe less PPE than we're wearing now. But I think wearing a mask to intubate people is probably something that's going to be sticking with us now. And just thinking a bit more about our infection control and what could possibly be going on, I think that will stay with us. Yeah.
Interesting. Anything else you'd like to add that you feel you, when I told you what I was trying to do, what, you know, that you thought, I must tell him about such and such before we've closed?
Not particularly, no. I was thinking about sort of when I did my first COVID intubation, was actually with my best friend who's an ITU consultant, and she sort of phoned me up and said, oh, we've got our first one, could you mind coming to give me a hand? We went into the cubicle in ITU, which was the place where we'd started off doing the intubations because of the negative pressure and things. And it was just all a bit of an unknown and a slightly strange environment where we kind of locked ourselves in this bubble of a room and knew that we couldn't go back out again until the job was done. And it all went smoothly and it went fine. And that patient actually did very well. But thinking about how it felt on that night, that was about 3 o'clock in the morning, how it felt on that night compared to how it feels now. It's just the change is quite significant. You know, we kind of went in thinking, oh, I don't know what this is going to be like. whereas now it's just like kind of clockwork now. So
very scary. It must have been awful. Thank you so much for...
Oh, it's a pleasure.
...for talking to me. And, you know, it's been very, very instructive for me. And some of the things you've said, I was thinking as you were saying them, this is exactly what I wanted to hear.
Oh.
Well, because this is the sort of information that in 20, 30 years' time, if, God forbid, this happens again, they will be able to turn to and hear and think, well, it worked for them, let's try it their way, or whatever. So yeah. I'm very, very...
Protocols and snacks. I think that is the two things. To protocols and snacks. You need to have protocols and you need to have snacks.
Thank you really very, very much, Natalie. I'm very, very grateful and look forward to meeting you in person sometime in the near future.
I know. Well, I was going to say WSM if you're there, but it's all online. I will be there online.
Are you going to just attend or are you speaking there?
No, I'm attending. I'm getting an award as well.
Oh, congratulations. What? Tell me about the award.
Oh, so I was on the, what was the GAC committee while I was on it, the trainee committee for 4 years. So it's related to that. It was just the work done on the GAC committee.
Thank you so much. So that's great. And stay well, stay safe.
You too.
Thank your husband for letting me take some of your valuable time.